rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Amerika zwischen Biden und Trump, das ist der Titel dieser Sendung. Die unmittelbare Gefahr für die Demokratie in den Vereinigten Staaten von Amerika ist mit der Niederlage für Donald Trump bei den Wahlen vor einem Jahr kleiner geworden. Verschwunden ist sie nicht. Es ist eine bittere Diagnose, die sich angesichts der fortschreitenden Polarisierung in der amerikanischen Politik aufdrängt. Am 6. Jänner dieses Jahres wollten rechtsradikale Trump-Anhänger das Kapitol stürmen. Trotzdem ist der abgewählte Präsident die Führungsfigur der amerikanischen Rechten nach wie vor. Unter seinem Einfluss gibt in der großen konservativen Partei des Landes, den Republikanern, eine rechtsradikale Strömung den Ton an. Die breite demokratische Koalition unter Präsident Joe Biden steht unter Druck. Im wichtigsten Bundesstaat, Virginia, haben die Republikaner den Gouverneursposten erobert mit einer Kampagne gegen antirassistische Inhalte im Schulunterricht. Immerhin haben die Demokraten im Kongress ein riesiges Investitionspaket durchgebracht, mit dem die marode Infrastruktur des Landes modernisiert werden soll. Aber niemand kann ein Comeback des rechten Demagogen Trump ausschließen. In einer Runde von Historikerinnen und Historikern in Wien, dem transformativen Salon, skizziert die Historikerin Lisa McGeer die Weichenstellung für die amerikanische Demokratie, die wir gerade erleben. McGeer forscht und unterrichtet an der Universität Harvard. Der Ausgang dieser Auseinandersetzung ist entscheidend für die Zukunft der liberalen Demokratie, auch in Europa. Moderatorin der Veranstaltung ist Katrin Karlweit von der Süddeutschen Zeitung. Doch hören Sie selbst. Lisa McGeer liefert ihre Analyse im transformativen Salon der Historiker in englischer Sprache.
Basically, as those of you who know American politics the past several years and certainly since November of 2020, there's grave worries about the state of democracy. And I think this is a great opportunity even today when the election for the governor of Virginia went to somebody who has been challenging critical race theory and picking up on white cultural resentments shows that this is ongoing post-Trump. So I want to talk in these 30 minutes about what I would term a kind of crisis of democracy, but I want to do so in three parts. Basically, I first want to lay out for those of you who are not close followers of American politics, what is it that's causing such deep consternation? What are the developments? What is going on? What's happening? Just kind of recap what the situation is. And then second, I want to place the developments of today within what we historians believe is kind of an added value that we have beyond the day's headlines, which is to provide a deeper historical context to help us to understand how did we get to where we are today. And then finally, third and lastly, I'll conclude by sort of looking toward possibilities toward the future. What might the future hold? Now, I'm a historian, and historians aren't great at prognosis, but I will conclude with that and then open the floor for comments and discussion. Okay, so just in terms of where we're at today, obviously, November of 2020 and all of the events that followed, culminating on January 6th of 2021, have caused a great deal of alarm. They were preceded by Trump's 4 years in office, eroding the fabric of democracy. But by January 6th, the crisis was full blown. At that point, Trump had called, after months of calling out about stolen votes, found votes, fabricated votes, months of lies about the electoral process. He called his voters to Washington after all his other efforts had failed to overturn the results. And basically, in what was really a kind of feckless but real coup attempt, his loyal followers basically engaged in an insurrection at the nation's capital, a very unprecedented event in itself. And what I want to say about that is that, as we know, American democracy withstood the test at that moment, right? Trump's efforts were clearly turned back at every stage of the game. He left office peacefully. Joe Biden came in, was inaugurated in what seemed to be a reinvigoration of the United States as a kind of multicultural, multiracial democracy with Kamala Harris at his side, the first Asian American and African American female vice president, all seemed to be positive signs for a kind of return to an alternative tradition of a more robust democracy. But if that was the case, we wouldn't be here today and having this discussion about what the future might hold and what is still ongoing. Trump did leave office, but that should not reassure us about the current state of American democracy. Since 2021, and even before, from last fall until January 6th and beyond, the Republican Party itself has shown very serious anti-democratic tendencies throughout the fall into January 6th. Many of those within the Republican Party either remained silent or spoke out and backed up Trump's false claims of election fraud. On January 6th itself, 147 Republican Party congressmen voted to object to the certification of the election, effectively calling to overturn the results of a legitimate election with no grounds. That's a scary sign, and that is why there are all these alarms. Since that time, of course, we're in well into 2021, Republicans have used all of those claims to initiate whole sets of restrictive voter laws to undermine the right to vote. So, in other words, what happened in the fall not only eroded trust of a large portion of the population, the Republican Party, in the legitimacy of the machinery of democracy, but it created the justification for a whole set of laws at the state level to restrict the right to vote. Why? Under the guise, of course, of shoring up the integrity of the ballot. Right? So that the language that's used, securing the ballot, shoring up the integrity of the ballot, but really the intention is to tamp down on turnout, tamp down on especially the vote of poor African-Americans that are heavily Democratic in the cities, which was the focus really of the calls of corruption in last fall, right? The focus was on places like Detroit, Philadelphia, heavily Democratic, heavily African-American areas. So what kind of laws have been passed at the state level? It depends where you look, but a whole host of states have passed a series of restrictive laws ranging from much tougher voter ID laws, shortening polling hours, making it harder to register, shortening the number of polling places, removing mail-in ballot boxes, making it harder to mail in your ballot, all sorts of means of restricting the vote. Now that comes out of course, November, because November was the most robust turnout since the early 20th century, right? There was an incredible turnout because states had made it easier to vote. So they're trying to sort of pull in that, and also had all sorts of new laws. In Georgia, for example, it's now illegal. You can be charged with a crime if you offer water to somebody who's waiting in line to cast their ballot. And in the United States, those lines can be very long, especially, again, in urban areas. You don't see those kind of lines in the suburbs. You see them very strong in these urban centers. So other kinds of laws are adding flexibility for Republican-dominated legislatures to effectively have more flexibility in controlling and overturning the votes of those local decision makers in those urban centers. So as my colleagues, Danny Ziblatt and Steve Levitsky argued recently, that could lead in a close election to Republicans effectively really almost trying to steal the vote, but legally through all of these legal mechanisms that are now being put in place. Coming back to Steve Levitsky and Danny Ziblatt again, I think in 2018, they published a very prescient book, How Democracies Die. And in that book, they argued that what is so frightening is precisely the kind of slow erosion that's been happening in the United States and that's been culminating in 2021 is the way that we've seen democracies erode in other parts of the world. In other words, most recent autocratic regimes that have been established, as you probably know, have not been established through revolution. They've not been established through coup d'etats. They've been established while maintaining the norm, the kind of formal procedures of a democracy, by holding elections, by adhering to a kind of level of constitutionality and legality. And you can look at that in Turkey, you can look at it in Hungary and Russia and Brazil and many places, but still eroding really democracy itself, robust democracy, becoming kind of illiberal democratic regimes. So I won't get into more detail about the voting laws. We can talk about that later, but it's just important to note this is all sort of an effort to undermine systematically the right to vote, especially of minority communities and poor communities who tend to run Democratic. And of course, just to tamp down on turnout, because by and large, turnout tends to favor the Democratic Party. Not always, but it tends to. Okay, so what I want to do now is, you know, just to note, to finalize that contemporary moment piece, we are at an inflection point, and I think it's a good moment, therefore, to have this kind of discussion. So I want to then turn to what got us here, or to talk about sort of how can we explain the Republican Party's growing embrace of these anti-democratic practices. Can we lay responsibility at the feet of Donald Trump, his willingness to flout the rule of law, his self-dealing, his unending fabrications and lies, his propensity to embrace violence? Well, partially, he's congealed, I think, vulnerabilities within the American democratic system that were there earlier. But again, we need to go back in time to really understand the deeper roots and origins that got us to this point. Trump did not come out of nowhere, and neither did the Republican Party's embrace of Donald Trump. What I think is important to note, I'm just going to make sure I'm watching my time here. So, oops, I forgot to start the timer.
I'm watching, but I'm not giving you a sign.
You're going to give me a sign. Okay, good. I think I'm good still. Yeah. Okay, so basically, going back in time, the United States, of course, likes to present itself to the world and is, you know, sort of has a self-identification as a kind of robust democracy. Will bring democracy and freedom to the world, kind of a, you know, sort of a guiding light of those features as kind of the oldest, longest lasting modern democracy. But what's really important is that anti-democratic traditions have been a powerful part of American political ideas since really the nation's establishment. And I think it's those illiberal traditions that we need to tease out to understand the deeper roots of what's happening today. So for example, just to give you one example, while the Capitol insurrection was unprecedented, the Capitol insurrection was by far not the first time that Americans have sought to overturn elections through violence, right? To go back, Eric Foner has written a terrific seminal book on Reconstruction. He's talked a lot about this. If you look at the Reconstruction era, after the end of slavery, when the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendment guaranteed African Americans the right to vote, you had the establishment of biracial state governments in many states in the South, right? Well, in some of those places, there were serious, I mean, there was a lot of violence, but there were actual successful coup attempts in several cases. In Colfax, Louisiana, in 1873, a group of whites in the county went down to the courthouse, massacred a whole set of African-American militiamen, and took over, basically overthrew the government. A year later, in 1874, also in Louisiana, federal troops had to go down to thwart a coup that was in progress to undermine the legally, legitimately elected government. And finally, at the end of the tail end of the century, as Eric Foner pointed out in a recent article in Wilmington, North Carolina, you see a biracial elected government was ousted as armed whites took control. So it's just to point out that there are earlier traditions and anti-democratic sentiments that go back a long time. Of course, it's in the wake of the end of Reconstruction, with the reestablishment of white supremacy in the South, that you have Jim Crow laws that again undermined the right to vote of non-whites in the South for close to 60 years or more, right? So those anti-democratic, autocratic propensities were very powerful in the South, and African Americans were disfranchised wholly and fully, but so were many other non-white groups, Native Americans and many other non-whites as well. I just point this out because the level of restriction, I think we tend to underestimate the extent of some of those features. So in Virginia, for example, in 1912, how many Virginians voted in the presidential election of 1912? Well, 150,000 out of a population of 2 million. 150,000 out of a population of 2 million should give you some sense about the restriction of the processes of democracy itself. So the machinery of democracy was somehow formalized, but all sorts of laws, from poll taxes to literacy clauses, kept African Americans and many poor whites from accessing the polls at all. Now, 4.5 million last November out of 8.5 million Virginians voted. You see how different that is, right? So it's just to note that depth of kind of propensity toward anti-democratic or sort of, thinking in US history. It's also just to remind some of you who are not real students of American history, the structure of American government as well is fundamentally anti-majoritarian in some of its features, which I think has encouraged the Republican Party to adopt the kind of strategies that it has recently. So ostensibly, what the US likes to think of itself as the greatest democracy, it is ironic, of course, that the popular vote, it's not the popular vote by which we choose the president, right? We choose the president through an intermediary body, which is called the Electoral College. Remember, the US Constitution was established over two centuries ago, and as a result, by now, it seems by current 21st century standards of what constitutes a democracy, somewhat reactionary in certain of its features, or anti-majoritarian. So that electoral college is specifically means, of course, that you can win a presidential election without winning the popular vote. because it's representation by states. It's a federal system. The Electoral College is state representation. Those electors decide according to who wins in that state. And then winner take all, most of the time, those electors then vote for that that candidate. But it means that you can still have a popular vote that is falls short of your Electoral College win. And that's happened several times in US history, and it's happened most recently. It's only one presidential election where Republicans won since 1988, has it been in fact winning by the popular vote. George Bush in 2004 won the popular vote. George Bush in 2000 did not. Donald Trump did not in 2016. Had he won the Electoral College this time, he would have also definitely not won the popular vote, since Biden won out by 7 million. But he did not. It was close, but he did not win. It just gives you some sense about these kind of anti-democratic features. And of course, the Senate is another anti-democratic feature. The control itself over the electoral laws at the federal level. Most electoral laws are established at the state level, but the federal government can make decisions about whether they want to rein in some of these laws. The problem is that, of course, the Republicans don't want to create robust voter laws, and they have the power at the federal level to impede Democrats who want to secure a more robust right to vote. Why do they have that power in the Senate? Not because they represent most more Americans, but because, again, the Senate is representation is done state by state, right? Two senators per state, which means Wyoming and Nevada has a great deal more political power in terms of passing legislation than does New York or California. So it's really just important to remember those features. And I think those features contribute, again, to the circumstances that we're in today. But at the same time, I think what's really important is that the Republican Party, it's not really until now that you see the full blossoming of these anti-democratic features. And so that needs to be explained, right? So despite these kind of anti-majoritarian tendencies, for most of the 20th century, from Dwight D. Eisenhower certainly forward, the Republican Party was a big tent, non-kind of disciplined party that sought to draw in moderates, sought to draw in Democrats. It really saw itself as a kind of more centrist party, right? It sort of embraced the reforms of the New Deal. It called for large infrastructure projects and for money for education, things that are unimaginable in today's Republican Party. So how did we get that shift? How did that happen? It's really, I think, in the moment of the past 40 some odd years, and since the 1980s, that we see that Republican Party has rejected a kind of more bipartisan form of liberalism in favor. It's become a much more Southern and Western oriented party that is far more conservative.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And I think the result has been since the 1980s, once Ronald Reagan came into the White House, there's been an erosion of a lot of the kind of regulatory mechanisms, an erosion of the kind of really welfare state provisions that have left many Americans feeling bereft and feeling aggrieved. And I think that can help us really explain what has happened more recently. If you think about sort of the kind of ever-growing income inequality that's resulted from those policies, along with declining standards of livings and the kind of thinning out of the middle class, the 2008 economic crisis, along with the ever more browning of America, right? The sort of the real fact that the United States is in, for example, California, already majority minority, and the census has declared if trends continue, it will be majority-minority within 3 decades. So there is this sense, I think, among that kind of white middle class, a feeling of displacement, which has been also encouraged by these economic policies. And I think as a result, these kind of currencies of isolationism, nativism, have come racism, conspiratorial thinking that were somewhat sidelined at mid-century have come really roaring back. Trump, in other words, became the messiah of Magalang by basically picking up on the grievances that had already been really flourishing at the grassroots and that had already congealed a set of thinking and ideas that he then mobilized. Building the wall was touted in the 80s and 90s by Republicans at the grassroots, right? Militarizing the border, ending birthright citizenship. This did not come from Trump. It came from Republican Party ranks and Republican Party officials who used it to win elections. In Orange County, a place that I've studied well, first at Suburban Warriors and then gone back again to look at some changes, in 1988, armed guards were stationed outside voting places to intimidate voters and basically to undermine the right to vote. They wrote down license plates of those who were coming in to vote. They basically declared that they were fearful that Democrats were going to bus in illegal immigrants. So these strategies and tropes have long been a part of Republican Party sort of strategies. Ballot security, the idea of ballot integrity, is not something new in 2021. Republican Party put out sort of programs and guides of how to work toward ensuring the integrity of the ballot, which really just meant using technical means to get votes thrown out from your opponent and securing them for the Republican Party, again, was something that happened already in the late 80s and 90s. But those ideas were not the dominant, total dominant part of the party, right? There was a whole nother wing of the party that embraced a more majoritarian strategy, a more immigrant-friendly strategy. We can reach out to Hispanics. Latinos are naturally kind of socially conservative, right? Let's draw in the Asian American and Latino vote with kind of, you know, peons to economic independence, to cultural conservatism. George Bush is well known for that, the idea of compassionate conservatism. And by the mid-2000s, it was pretty clear that trajectory was sidelined in favor of a far more kind of nativist, exclusionary approach to appeal to overwhelmingly its white social base and to hope to draw in other white voters to make up for the losses of those that would no longer be sought after, the Hispanics and others. So basically, Trump Republicanism, this anti-democratic ethos that he's embraced, is much more than about Donald Trump. And it, I think, threatens to be the Republican blueprint for at least for the near future. It has been very much sort of a very strong swath of Republican Party identity. And you know, this pandering to white cultural resentments continues on today, as we saw most recently with the Virginia election. These tendencies toward this kind of exclusionary, illiberal, anti-democratic politics. Are you going to give me a sign?
Yes, 5 minutes.
5 minutes, good. Okay, I'm getting there. I'll be there. That they come to the fore in moments particularly of both super high-end income inequality and economic anxiety. So if you go back in U.S. history, look at a moment like the 1920s, when the Ku Klux Klan gained a tremendous amount of power, right? 5 million members controlled the states of Indiana and Colorado, among other places, with a very strong exclusionary white Christian nationalism, anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic sentiment. That was a historic moment in the 20th century of that high income inequality. And you see those similar kind of tendencies. It's economic anxieties, I think, that helped to generate, in particular, the strength of this kind of politics. and its resonance, let's say, among the population. So that all may not sound very hopeful. And so I want to end a little bit with a more helpful note. That is to say, there have been failures of redistribution, I would argue, you know, that has led to these kind of discontents. But there is another side. There are those who are pushing for obviously more progressive politics. And the Democratic Party, of course, has been pushing for more robust voting laws. And I think in the alarmism over democracy, we tend to forget. The Brennan Center has published a sort of a survey of the number of shifts in voting laws. And while Republicans are pushing to tamp down on the vote, 26 states have actually passed measures to expand the vote. So it's not all one thing. The January 6th insurrection took all of the air out of that day. But that day was historic because it was the day when John Ossoff and Ralph Warnock were elected to the Senate, the first Jewish senator and the first Black senator from Georgia, a historically racially discriminatory state. Those are real, real boons for a notion of America as a robust democracy, and perhaps also suggest that there may be another path forward. So just to end then, I think most of all, there needs to be a reestablishment of a sense of common purpose, a belief that those Americans who are left behind have some way of having a sense of re-including them. Because, you know, their turn toward nativism and populism is not the only way to go. There's malleability among discontented Americans' sets of politics. Think back to 2016, when Donald Trump, in that primary, gained the vote, when he, in the general election, won the votes of those white working class rural men and women. They had often gone, those same voters, for Bernie Sanders, right? So there isn't, these politics are malleable. Class grievances can move in one direction, they can move in another. That's not to say it will happen, but it is certainly a hope that with a set of robust progressive politics and mobilization, that a revitalized, more progressive democracy can be established. I know that sounds, it's an alarming moment, but I just want to leave us with some sense also of it's not over by any stretch of the imagination.
Thank you very much. So there's a glimmer of hope. I have a few very obvious questions that probably many of us have before we go on. First question, you said this party has become much more conservative, but Trump isn't conservative. Trump is about Trump. Trump is about power. Trump is about narcissism. Trump is about, you know, being right. So where is the extremely conservative agenda in those politics?
Well, I think actually what Trump has done politically in office is largely meet the demands of the elite segment of the Republican Party that favors deregulation, favors getting rid of economic controls over the market, favors getting the U.S. out of the climate control agreement. All of that is classic conservative Republican fare. So in that, what he's done, for the most part, total Republican fare. What he hasn't done, this verbal rhetoric, he never built that wall, because Republican parties, were they going to vote for that? They're never going to vote for that. But he appeals to those voters' sentiments with that kind of populist language of nativism, but he hasn't achieved it, and nor does he really, I think, even try, because he knows he can't, and he's not that himself. You're right, he's about Trump, yeah, but he knows,
because populism isn't conservatism all the time, you know,
not always, but in the agendas of what's actually passed, it has been, right? So I think that's really important to separate out. It's a language of populism, but in what actually has come out of it in terms of actual policy has largely favored everything that Mitch McConnell and all of those Republicans want, which is why they're so behind Trump, because they made a Faustian bargain. We're going to get what we want. We're going to get conservative court picks we wanted for years. We're going to get the policies that we wanted of deregulation, and we're going to have to deal with this kind of stuff, which is, this is what our loyal base wants.
Two more quick questions. Second question, you said there is, I don't even dare to say that. I thought it wasn't not allowed, but you talked about the Browning of America. But again, some doubt, because part of the people who voted for him were, for example, those Latin Americans who have been driven out of the country or not even let in. So how does that work?
Well, their Republican Party had a much more robust tie on the Hispanic vote earlier, and they are. Trump does speak to some of them, but by far not the vast majority of them. I mean, the Democratic Party as a whole on over 70% of Hispanic votes. But there is some appeal, especially for those who feel I made it here. I want those who come in behind me to come in legally, right? So Trump can play to that card. I think that is undoubtedly true. But say what the rest of your question was, because as part of that, so.
That's fine. I wanted to ask a third one. The third question is, you said there's a Faustian pact. And as we know, most of those 180 senators voted
140
something, 147 voted against Biden's election into office. But at the same time, for example, now in Virginia, the guy who was voted governor tried to distance himself from Trump. The Bushes, for example, tried to distance themselves from Trump. So there seems to be two different camps. Why would you win an election in Virginia by saying I'm not a Trumpist?
So I think it's correct that probably the Republican Party somewhat wants to separate itself from the most lawless aspects of Trumpism. After all, it was pretty horrid scenes what happened on January 6th. They themselves were under attack. So I don't think that didn't have an impact on the party. But they did not at all do what I thought they would do, which was to come out clearly and totally distance themselves from Donald Trump. They did on that day. Mitch McConnell came out and condemned Donald Trump, and a few others did as well, for being responsible for the events of that day. But since then, everything that that folks have tried to do to investigate what happened and who was responsible, the Republican Party is not willing to go there. They also have basically allowed Trump to remain the kind of head of the Republican Party informally. They've not distanced themselves at all. I think you're right. In Virginia, because it's a more moderate state, he's been more careful, but has also pandered to these cultural resentments in the same way. So I think the heirs to Trump may distance themselves from those most horrible, lawless features, but will still pander to those same kind of cultural resentments. That's what my sense is.
Sie hörten die amerikanische Historikerin Lisa McGeer bei einer Veranstaltung vom 3.11.2021. Organisiert wird der transformative Salon von Historikerinnen und Historikern der Universität Wien vom Research Center for the History of Transformations, bei dem ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit bedanke. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören. Historische Hintergrundanalysen können Sie regelmäßig im Falter lesen. Mit einem Abonnement des Falter sind Sie immer gut informiert. Ein Falter-Abo ist auch ein nützliches Weihnachtsgeschenk. Sie bleiben damit bei den Beschränkten das ganze Jahr in guter Erinnerung. Alle Informationen finden Sie im Internet unter der Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Philipp Dietrich betreut die Audiotechnik im Falter. Ich verabschiede mich. Bis zur nächsten Folge.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.